Thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Mark Ward, and today I'm talking about the role of the CISO with Greg Vandergast. He's currently Security Chief at supplier discovery startup ScoutB. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Good to speak to you. I wanted to talk because you wrote a book called Rethinking InfoSec that I read, and it's drawn from your experiences in the field, in the profession. And a lot of the examples in that, a lot of what your conclusions you came to really resonated with some of the work that the ISF's done on the role of the CISO and how it's changing. So I just wanted to explore that a bit, just talk about that. And I guess first question was just about why you think information security needs to be rethought. What was it that prompted that title?
I struggled a bit with the title, but in the end, I think it's maybe not so much a rethink as we need to think in the first place. I think there's been a lot of standardization. We have a very defined way of doing things, but we know historically that's just not very effective. And being self-taught and kind of bending towards the will of the industry and then taking a step back again, I realized that there's better ways of doing this. There's much more effective ways of doing this, both cost-wise and assurance-wise.
So when you say better ways, I mean, is it just your approach is different to a lot of the other CISOs? I mean, the reason I asked that question is because we did some work last year on and talked to quite a lot of CISOs, and there were a few that were clearly doing things a bit differently. They weren't steeped in that profession. They weren't following those processes and policies as closely as some of the others. So is that where the rethinking comes in, just that basics, just how you approach the whole job?
Yeah, I think it's just a general kind of more holistic consideration of not just security, but of you know, what are we trying to achieve in the context of the organization? You know, like what are our risks? How do we work? And it's not just about risk. You know, if we can create value, why shouldn't we create value? And that can be, you know, branding, and it can be exposure for the company. It can be, you know, security quite often is a quality issue. So why can't I do quality enhancement that gives me a better product, better process, lower costs? These are all ways of doing it that most people don't consider. Instead of just blindly creating this InfoSec silo all the time, just throwing a bunch of resource at that.
Yeah, because I think there's a few points in the book where you talk about just the treadmill that a lot of organizations are on in terms of, like, say, spending more money to solve the same kind of problems. And you seem to step back a bit from that and be less about that process and more about, like, say, understanding the business and maybe getting at the fundamentals of the problems. So is that where some of this change comes in as well?
Yeah, a lot of it. I think the very, I mean, now I'm very much focused on, you know, the very leadership level and the culture level and that kind of stuff. But the very kind of beginning of this thinking was just, and it's gaining traction now, it's just the shifting things left. Like, why am I spending so much money trying to do all this detection and response and all this pen testing and forensics and all this stuff? It's very far downstream. Like 90%, you know, maybe not 90%, but somewhere between 50 and 90% of my security effort and spend is very reactive. And it's addressing issues that have, you know, been put into, you know, the assembly line, because everything's a car analogy for me, further upstream. So why don't I go and fix that process so that these issues don't occur anymore? And that's where you get this kind of resistance from that established information security silo and established job functions and established, you know, three lines of defense model and this and that, where, well, that's not your job. That's somebody else's job. It's like, well, I think we need to start, like, owning this stuff and being altruistic to the business and actually getting involved. Like, if I can do something that's going to save the business money, both in security costs and, you know, other benefits as well. Again, you know, quality, consistency, agility, these are all things that if you have, you know, good, clean, agile IT, you benefit from. Why wouldn't I do that? And I remember a couple of years ago, I was quite bemoaning. I was looking at, like, a lot of CISO resumes, and so many of them were talking about, was one of the first things on the resume was their ability to increase security spending. Like their ability to get the company to spend more money on security. It's like, I don't want to spend more money on security. I want the company, I treat it like it's my business, right? I want everything to work well together, and I want to maximize my profit, and I want to spend as little money as possible achieving any of the business functions that I need. Yeah, I've worked in a lot of organizations where it's these huge security silos, and they've just become fiefdoms, and they find ways of billing things And the actual level of assurance, the performance of the security functions is horrendous. So, it comes down to altruism, I think.
Yeah, and I guess it, based on, those experiences, what you saw, and in some respects, just wasn't working, because certainly that complaint that CISOs don't have enough money to do the job they think needs doing is a very common one. And that certainly a lot of the CISOs we talk to, that's the one thing. Can I get in front of the board? Can I get more money from them? Can I get the buy-in from it? But as well, I think it was, there's a few CISOs who were very much like yourself and saw that they needed to step out from that office, from that fiefdom, as you called it, and become more of a diplomat and more of a advisor to the business and just get more involved. Because a lot of them do, unfortunately, sit behind keyboards, because that's where a lot of them came from. I think there's a lot of still that very technical aspect to it that they're comfortable with, and perhaps that's what they stick with.
Yeah, I think there's a stigma there that's both bad, because if I approach, so yeah, let me go back, because you do hear that complaint a lot, like, oh, I don't have the budget. First of all, you don't have support. Most places lack support, and I would trade, or traction, and I would. In 90% of cases, I would trade. Here, I'm throwing out random statistics, like I'm a security vendor or something. I would trade traction for budget, because again, security spending tends to be incredibly inefficient. And in most cases, you're better off spending less money but having more traction from the organization to help you do things further upstream.
By traction, you mean making the business do what you think needs doing, or yeah, at least helping guide it and get it to act rather than spending money on tools.
Getting that buy-in and that support. You know, if they're just outputting a bunch of platforms that are horrendous and I need to spend a fortune in security spending to stay up track of it, it makes more sense to, you know, fix the root cause of the problem. There are definitely cases where there are, you know, well-intentioned security people who don't have either traction or resource, and they feel very much stuck. And it's, well, I can't because my CIO is blocking me, this or that. And this is, I think, when you're C-level, I think the CISO role has been a C-level role on paper or in title, but it's almost always reported to another C-level function. And the people doing that are not operating in what you would consider a true C-level leadership mentality. If you have a problem, you fix the problem. If the problem is your CIO is blocking you, you go talk to his boss, or you go talk to the board, or you go, you know, and it's not that difficult. I used to do this back when we were allowed to do public speaking. I talked about this point a lot. And I would just always pick a random person in the audience, give them a compliment, like your watch, what's your name, Steve, can I buy you a cup of coffee? I'd love to tell you something. The answer is always yes. So you can do that. And you have to really start using those engagement skills, those influencing skills. And then you have to be able to communicate strategically what you want. You have to understand for these people, it's about your credibility. You ask for something, they give it to you. It's that simple. You can get a $500,000 addition to your budget in 30 seconds if you have that credibility. It's that easy if you're doing it right. But those are skills that we're really, really lacking in the security space. Yeah. And a lot of people feel trapped, but they don't realize you can step outside of that box and achieve those things and really influence all kinds of things in the organization. And I think in security, it's a great place because security affects everything, or everything affects security. So if you have that top level support, it really lets you kind of sniff around all parts of the business. And quite often you're the only one who's looking at the different silos of the business at the same time. And you spot synergies that other people have missed, maybe in marketing or in sales or in PR or engineering. And you're able to, my goal is always to contribute to the business more than I need to secure it. So I should be generating revenue. Most of it's indirectly, but it should be generating revenue. You know, I can make security part of the brand value. I can talk a lot about what we're doing about security, which gives the brand exposure. That may lead to some additional sales. I can talk about security features, how serious we are about it, how far we take it, how transparent we are, and educate people about the value of their data. And then that makes them ask our competitors some tough questions. Well, do you do all this? Are you this transparent? Will you let us see this and that? And they can't answer that in a positive way. And then they come to you, and you may be able to charge an extra 10% for that, because that they're willing to pay it.
Yeah, it does surprise me that more organizations don't make more of how secure they are, because I think they don't know. And there is a lot of, I think a lot of organizations do work in that very old fashioned way, and they are little,
it's interesting because a lot of
empires, something.
Yeah, a lot of companies still operate in that mindset of people don't really care about security, but so make them care, you know, make some awareness to it. You know, I get, it's got to be quite often we have these companies asking us, you know, we're very concerned about data security. We want to know how you encrypt things like at rest and in transit. I was like, well, AES 256-bit encryption and TLS 1.2, 1.3, because we use AWS and that's standard and everything. And they're, oh, yes, very good. Okay. And deliver. It's like, you've not asked me if I have an accurate asset inventory, if I'm patching, if my roles are defined, if what my RBAC model is, what's my JML process. There's a million other things you haven't asked me about. And quite often they don't understand, oh, it's encrypted, it's safe, there's a password. It's like, yeah, but someone with the wrong access level requests it, the system will decrypt it for them. So it's completely pointless. But a lot of them, they don't realize that. So if you educate them, then they start caring a lot more. And then they start asking more serious questions. And then two things. You can be that person who really wants to do a good job, and then you stand out from the crowd. Or you can be that person who is just, you know, doing the tick box status quo. And that's very bad news for you, because you're about to lose business to me.
Yeah. Well, I'd certainly because you said this is a simple thing. And I think for a lot of CISOs, it isn't simple, because they don't have those kinds of skills and didn't grow up with that background. But talking to some CISOs who were exhibiting some of those, what we call next gen characteristics, some of the straightforward things they did, like solve really minor problems, started to build up that credibility. Yeah. And as well, they built on that, and then they became that diplomat. And like you say, the CISO, I've talked to quite a lot of CISOs now, and they're really interesting people, because they do sit at that nexus of all kinds of influences and situations in a business. And they should be the ones that are in that point of being able to get people together and say, you guys have got a lot in common. You've got the same, we've all got the same kind of aim, but you more than others, let's get something done here. And they definitely, some of the CISOs I talked to were politicians.
Yeah,
in that sense.
To me, it comes down to, I think if I could like simplify it to two basic attributes. One is, I hate waste. So if I see like a can on the street, I will pick it up, but I don't want to throw it in the bin because that won't get recycled. I'll walk around with it for half an hour so I can take it home and put it in the recycling. And it's the same thing with business processes, the same people, same thing with people, you know, getting the potential out of people. That's the whole other farce, the hiring and cybersecurity. So that's one, just hating waste. And the second one is, I'm incredibly lazy. I don't want to be you know, fixing stuff that's going to be broken again the next day. It's like, I want to fix the root cause, make the minimum effort, and then have everything fix itself over time because I've addressed the root cause, and then go for driving my car. You know?
Right. I think we all want that, don't we?
Yeah.
But it's interesting, because I think, slightly frivolously, I applied your thinking to a situation I've got at home, because I don't live in a particularly rural area, but we have a problem with mice. Just keep getting into the house and eating things, and it's just, you know, dirty, and I wish there was a way to sort it out. But actually there is, because instead of endlessly chapping and killing mice or throwing them out again and they just come back, I looked for why are they getting in. So I stepped back from that, you know, symptom, and said, well, where how are they getting in? And I blocked all the holes, and we haven't had a problem with mice for ages.
So I think
a lot of CISOs are very much, like you say, in that symptom, sort of trying to trap the mice rather than step and go, how are they getting in? And taking that much bigger view. I mean, it's a frivolous example, but I think it did strike me in your book that there is a moment of clarity a lot of CISOs need to go through, that they need to sort of get to that point of going, hang on, this is not working. Maybe there's a different way to do this. And the next gen CISO work, the ISF did find some people who had gone through that. But I guess, is there ways to teach this? I'm curious about the response from industry when you do those presentations, or if other people read the book and said, it'd be nice if I could do this, but I can't.
It's interesting. It's so much critical thinking. So I'm a high school dropout. I have no formal education. I started messing around with computers and just figuring out what's the best way of doing this. And it's interesting how, I mean, quite often, And I've done this, you know, this analogy is in the book as well. And it's the car factory analogy where the cars are being built, but then they're being thrown into the parking lot from the third floor. So they're all mangled. So you get this, you know, tons of process and governance and vendors selling tools and process and quality assurance standards and prioritization of what needs to be repaired and in what order, what parts are needed, blah, blah, blah. And you know, you get this entire multi-billion pound industry gets set up around that. And we need to hire these six-figure, you know, 10-year experience CISSP, whatever's. And then you get like a kid straight out of school, like, well, why are we dumping cars from the third floor? Exactly. I mean, the fact that you've not been indoctrinated by all these quote unquote, you know, valuable certifications and training makes you strategically far more valuable because you're still looking at things objectively. And I've had tremendous success hiring people that absolutely no one wanted. And they made phenomenally high performance teams. So I don't know how you teach, you know, critical thinking. It's very, very tricky. Hopefully, you know, I think it's a drop at a time, you know, maybe this podcast will help with that, but,
I'm certainly curious to see what reaction it gets from ISF members. Cause I think a lot of them are, well, certainly the interviews we did, there was quite a few who were, because the interviews were often complaining in frustrated ways about their organization and they wish they could do more. And there was a few CISOs who had managed via a variety of means to get to that point of being that trusted advisor, solving those problems, having that credibility and getting their organization to act on, so actually having that traction, but they're relatively rare still, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I just wonder, sort of, do you get people coming to you saying, Greg, how do I do this in my own organization? Or is it one of those you have to be there and it's hard to pass on in that sense? You have
organization. I mean, I try to convey it. So even with like university graduates, it's funny how everyone's really focused on offensive security. Everyone, well, either forensics or pen testing is what everyone wants to be a pen tester. It's like, does no one actually want to secure anything? And you know, oh, well, we secure things because we find the holes and then they fix the holes. Like, yeah, but you've not fixed the thing that led to the hole being there in the first place. So that definitely, I don't think the educational system is working. So yeah, again, it's.
I think as well, a lot of security researchers come to it. They are not self-taught, but they follow a path that a lot of the people have trailblazed, like for bug bounties and things like that. And certainly talking to some firms who do training, they said there's a real preponderance of those red team skills. And once people join a security department, then they have to get training to do the other stuff that's going to be useful to that organization. Yeah. And I think maybe that's where the process starts and they do start to think about, let's solve the symptoms rather than look deeper at it.
Yeah, and I'm also quite flexible. So I'm hiring a team now and, you know, I combine the kind of head of information security with DevSecOps, and I'm not calling them either of those things. I've got a role that's the program and quality management. I've got another role that's product and infrastructure security. And I've moved things around because I created a vision of this team with kind of standardized roles. And then I started talking to candidates and they're like, well, you're not perfect in the traditional sense of this, but our environment isn't the standard environment either. Like every organization is different. And this is something that security people tend to be really bad at. We apply a standard way of working and we don't consider the uniqueness of our organization. And quite often we know very little about our own organization. So it's absolutely important to discover everything, not just from an asset management standpoint, which we're bad enough at, but also to understand, you know, what's the business strategy? Who are these departments? What are they doing? What are they working with? What's the goal here? So when I'm looking at these candidates, and it's a similar thing on their end, they've got certain skills that I would have liked to see, but they don't have. And then they've got other skills that they have that I wasn't looking for. So I was like, well, how can I leverage this? How can I fill this gap in with that role? And can I, you know, I want to hire a, you know, my most junior role, and I'm looking at this girl who's got a marketing and graphic design background. I was like, this is fantastic because this is going to help me communicate stuff. This is going to help me create you know, document in pretty pictures data journeys and user journeys, and give that to the salespeople and educate our customers and help shorten our sales cycle for the security reviews and help educate the rest of the business. So sometimes I'm trying to make a point, I don't know how to illustrate it. She can illustrate it for me. This is a completely non-existent role in security, but fantastically useful in advancing security in my organization. So I changed the roles based on the candidates. You know, it's about, you have these great skills. It'd be stupid of me to insist on this, you know, kind of monochrome, traditional, two-dimensional role definition. Let me change it for you so that you can drive value. And just think of, you know, what do you have in the toolbox? What can you use? How can you best use it? What can you develop? You know, maybe instead of keeping the mice out of your house, you could trap them humanely and sell them for a quid on the corner. You know, who knows?
Yeah, start a pet shop or something like that. Yeah, I think because it was certainly, again, one of what came out of the ISF work was looking after staff. And there was, I think, what was interesting about the characteristics we picked out was that they did tend to feed on each other. And there was one about leadership, and there was one about, as well, getting the organization to take security seriously. And that had an impact on the way you could lead, because then you could see, good people that worked for you could see that the organization was taking them seriously. And then there was going to be a career path, and there could be some mentoring and training, et cetera, people being stretched and asked to do different things. And I think there's a virtuous circle that's emerged there.
Because there's in the UK, we have, I think it's the Chartered Institute for Information Security. It's the only, formally recognized institute in that way, and they're so huge about, and I'm sorry, but I despise them. Like, I'm so against what they're proposing, because they're trying to standardize everything. They're trying to standardize every single role, when security is basically about expecting the unexpected and anticipating the unexpected. So you can't standardize that in the first place. Second of all, you're not molding it to your organization. You're not molding it to the individual and absolutely unique talents and potential of every person. So you're not going to drive their potential out. It's just a bad idea. You just need to adapt way more. Like, stop trying to implement security like a checkbox of controls, and start thinking about, how does my organization work? How does the culture work? What systems do we have? You know, where does data come in? What are the risks? What's valuable? How can I protect that with this, you know, absolute massive toolbox of stuff in security land, but also just in good IT governance, good IT quality, good processes? How can I do that? Forget everything that's out there about how you're supposed to approach a program. And just do what works for your organization. If you're fitting it to your organization, it's going to work much better. It's going to drive better value. It's going to be way more sustainable and consistent as well, because you're not trying to put a round peg in a square hole and vice versa. And if you optimize things upstream as well, very often, you know, it's about fixing that root cause, and that root cause is rarely a security quote unquote thing itself. It's a lack of developer education, or a lack of configuration standards, or architectural standards, or practices, or whatever. Fix those, and you get a bunch of other benefits downstream. And I forget where I was going with that. But it creates value.
I was going to ask about if you've come across other security chiefs who are doing similar things to you. If there's a small group of people that think like you, or are you still a bit of a pioneer in some respects, or a bit of a, I'm not sure how you regard yourself, maverick? I don't know.
Less so than I used to, because we spoke a couple of weeks ago, and I was actually surprised that you were seeing as many people starting to think this way as well. You definitely hear about shift left. You definitely hear about more and more security people. You know, 10 years ago, we would have been absolute geeks that no one wanted to invite to dinner. Now there's more and more of them who are truly, you know, C-level executives. They never get their hands dirty. They think about strategy, people, culture, and that's it. So it's kind of starting, I hope. I'm hopeful. I mean, we can only keep going for so long, because it's not working.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think there's that moment of clarity for a lot of CISOs comes because maybe they do have a bad breach or something like that, or there's just, starting a new role and just see that things are not, something really seriously has to change. And certainly quite a lot of the CISOs, the interviews I did, there was a couple who had a really tough time their first few months because they came with that sort of gloss of the new job and trying to get things done. And then they started to do that work to find out how the organization worked. And they only had bad news to tell everybody. It's just difficult for them to sort of to go and say, sorry, but this needs changing and that needs changing. And I think they were really tested by that for sure, because it's after that, once you bed in, once you get that traction, things start to happen, you solve some problems, that it actually starts to change and you get taken more seriously, because now you've got better news to tell people.
And I think that's why it's so important to be thinking about the business rather than just security. Think of it as, this is your business, and you know, you care about the sales, you care about the marketing, you care about everything. You just happen to be doing security today. You don't want to stop anything. You don't want to slow anything down. You want to drive synergies absolutely everywhere. And once you start putting stuff in a non-security context, a business context, and stop talking about risk is the other big thing. We have so many avenues where we can actually contribute to the business. And again, you know, we can help them streamline processes. We can help them integrate silos. We can get rid of overhead. We can ensure better consistency. You know, I can build even security stuff I can build a framework that's bespoke to us, that's highly efficient, that can be easily mapped to SOC, ISO, or NIST, or you know, industry-specific compliance frameworks. That allows the business to pivot into those locales and those industries more quickly. So these are business benefits. And if you start putting things really in terms of business benefit, it's like, hey, this can be a part of our brand. This can be a talking point. We can generate awareness about this. We can use it as a justifier of a higher price point. These are all things that are going to be very, very interesting to your C-level and to your board. Security is just boring. No one cares. I don't even care. I don't, you know, I've got a 6-character password on my laptop. It's got no uppercases. So I just don't care. It's not my work laptop, but that's MFA. But because there's nothing on there that's that important to me. You know, I can cancel my credit cards, and you know, no one's that fussed about it. Especially people who are, you know, the amount of posts you see on LinkedIn about security people, like, oh my God, look at this. It's unbelievable that they did that. 99% of the population be like, so what, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you put it in terms of business context, it becomes far more relevant. And an analogy I've been playing with the last few weeks is kind of, well, since Father's Day, is kind of, if you tell your kid not to go to the rock concert, what's going to happen? Kid's going to go to the rock concert anyway. Mm-hmm. And if anything, they're going to like you less for it, or they're going to do it almost to spite you. Whereas, you know, and that's you trying to protect your kids by telling them what not to do and only what not to do isn't going to work. But if instead you build a relationship and you're there for them and you help them in their interests and you support them in those interests, then they want you around all the time. Like hey, it's just really enjoyable being with you. You're constantly adding value to my life. And it's like, hey, do you want to go to the rock concert together? And it's like, oh, yeah. I'd love to have you come with me, because you've built that relationship, that bond. And you were there the entire time looking out for them, but they have no idea that that's even happening. So you can provide value on all these other fronts and just protect because you want to be a protector without them even being that aware of it. You know, and if you... If they ever do question it, then you can explain it. If there is anything ever really bad, then you at least have, and you need to absolutely say, guys, no, then you have a far better chance of being listened to in that extreme case, because you've got that foundational relationship as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've got two teenage boys, and there's quite a lot of things they try to do in spite of our advice. But there's been a few situations where, I've tried to be, you know, draw my experiences and just say, look, you know, and that has, because of their teenagers, then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I think that transparency and giving them more the information they need is much better than just saying no for no good reason. It just definitely, you get better buy-in and response, and long term, hopefully it plays out better.
I just operate out of a standpoint where I don't assume that the business needs me. Like I need to provide real value to be wanted there. A lot of people are like, oh, you know, you're going to get breached and it's going to cost you a lot of money, so you need to give me some money so I can. It's like, that's not the right mentality to go about it. Like I always feel like I need to kind of justify why I'm there in my existence and to provide actual value to justify my salary, my team, my budget. And that value needs to be more than something of, oh, well, nothing bad's happened. That's because you spent those $20 million with us. It's like, is it really? Or has it just been luck? Yeah. So it's very hard to justify that. So I need to add something tangible to just that risk discussion.
I think for a lot of CISOs, they are, you know, I think that I sometimes wonder why they got into this role and where they want to be, what they want to be with it, what they want to do with it. And I think the, like with, you know, top sportsmen, say a tennis player or something like that, they didn't become a good tennis player just to be able to play, to beat everybody. They want to be tested and they want to be stretched and they want to try and, you know, exhibit their skill in different ways. And I think with CISOs, surely that's what you want to do, isn't it? You want the bigger challenges. You want to conquer those things.
I think
and CISOs are in a good place to be able to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a really, again, because you're spanning so many verticals, if you do it right, if you get that engagement, that communication working, it can be really, really rewarding because you're kind of, you know, you're like the Michael Clayton of the organization running around spotting things, trying to fix things. It can be quite cool. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's nowadays, it's about culture. It's about kind of root cause analysis. It's about leadership. Whether it's in security or something else, like that's not even... That doesn't even make that much. I'm tainted with this brush now of being a security person, which every time somebody asks you what is it you do, it's like, I have to explain this now.
I think that was the, again, one of the tensions in the role is that it's being less about security and more about that strategy, leadership, that culture. And I think it's difficult for people to walk away from that title because it is a C-level title. And if you don't have that, what do you have? And it's not quite become that other thing yet.
Yeah,
but I think there are some people who are finding out what it is, whether it's a more a business role, more a risk role, or what it is really. I think it's taking on a new shape, and it's taking a while to find what final form it has.
Yeah, because I mean, my reward is being of value to the organization. You know, the cyber threat thing is okay. That's my job, but that's not what's personally rewarding to me. What's personally rewarding is, hey, well. And I kind of like that we're security people, because we've been so bad at communicating, especially executive level for 20 plus years or however long it's been ever, we're automatically dismissed. If I want to, you know, approach a CEO and want to talk about information security, the first thing is like, oh, no, go talk to my CIO. I don't understand that techie crap. And it's like, well, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about a framework and strategizing and increasing your brand value and this and that. Like, oh, well, that's weird. That's not what I was expecting. But you're automatically dismissed. So to the fact that I have that extra resistance and overcoming it is actually quite rewarding. Getting that traction in a security context, which is normally has so much resistance, is rewarding. Developing people is rewarding. Hiring people that everyone else says are not qualified and then getting phenomenal results out of them just to prove everyone wrong and rub their nose in it is rewarding. And that's something where you're actually helping people and changing people's lives as well. So that's doubly rewarding.
Excellent. Thanks, Greg. That has been a very wide-ranging discussion, and I'm pretty sure we're out of time here. But thanks, huge thanks for your time. Always great to talk to you, get your ideas. Thanks to everybody else for listening as well. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about the ISF research, tools, and guidance. And that's it.
Thank you very much for having me.